your father-in-law, Maurice Bury, survived Operation Barbarossa. Could you tell me more about his story and experiences on the Eastern Front and how he escaped the Nazis?
Ah, okay. Well, it's all in the book, Army of Worn Souls. There's a plug. The story is, he was Canadian, born in Montreal. But his parents were Ukrainian immigrants. And when they left, the part of Ukraine they were from at the time was part of Poland. So they had a business in Montreal, but then the Depression came and things were tough. So they still had land in Poland, near Ternopil. So they decided that they would go, or part of the family would go back there where they could at least grow their own food. And things weren't great, but it was better. But that was in the 30s. And as you know, in 1939, the war started when Germany invaded Poland. And 2 weeks later, the USSR invaded from the east. And the two countries, the two dictatorships, divided Poland between them. So all of a sudden, Maurice finds himself a citizen of the Soviet Union. And then in 1941, he received his draft notice. And he tried to argue that he wasn't eligible as a Canadian citizen. He showed his Canadian birth certificate. And the response was, "You live here now, comrade. You fight for the motherland." And because he was in what they call gymnasium, which was sort of a college, post-secondary education there at the time, he was put into officer training. That wasn't finished before June 22nd when Germany invaded. So then he was in charge of a small unit. They retreated, as you know, across Ukraine until they were captured in a huge encirclement near Kharkiv. And he was put into a prisoner of war camp where he nearly starved, because that was the policy of the Nazi regime at the time. The Eastern POWs got half the rations that the Western ones did. So he eventually escaped, and he managed to get out with his men in his unit, 12 men, and they rode the rails across Ukraine back to the West. And when he returned home, he entered the resistance, the Ukrainian People's Revolutionary Army, or UNPA. Yeah, not UPA, but another organization similar to it, sort of almost a competitor.
So how did he manage to escape with his comrades?
One of the I guess Heavies or the foreign people in the prison camp just happened to be an old friend of his, and he found Maurice and promised to help him. Maurice refused to go without his men, so they arranged some fake uniform or some clothes and some forged passes that allowed them to get through various checkpoints. And then there was a bit of a ruse involving work detail outside the camp, and sort of spirited them away when others weren't looking. So it was quite a trick. And then from that point, it involved finding sympathizers along the route back home, and including a lady there. This is one of the stories that he told me that sort of sparked the idea of, I'm going to make this a book. But they're all standing there on a train platform near Kyiv, and they're hungry. They don't have any money, and they've been starved. And a woman saw them and said, I don't know where my son is. He's about the same age. And she bought them all a meal.
Wow. Yeah. Does his account of the Eastern Front differ from maybe like retrospective or commonly held historical views of it in any way?
It is. What I tried to bring out in the books is the way that for the people in Ukraine and other areas on the Eastern Front, it was a very complicated force, almost four-sided war, three to four sides on the, and for a lot of the people in the areas that were occupied by the Soviet Union before the war, they were fighting an oppressive Nazi invasion or occupation, but they also did not want this communist back. So there are examples up and down the Eastern Front. In Estonia, when the Soviet Union was coming back in 1944, a lot of the Estonians volunteered to resist them. They were helping the Germans at that point, but you know they also did not want the return of the communists. And that happened in Poland, it happened in Belarus, it happened in Ukraine. So it was everywhere.
Yeah. And for those who don't know much about Operation Barbarossa, could you give a brief overview about it and why did the Nazis start the campaign to begin with?
Well, there's a lot of books on that. But
yeah.
Okay. So in 1939, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was signed. So Hitler and Stalin became temporary allies. They signed a non-aggression pact, and it had a number of secret protocols in the pact that didn't come out until after the war, although it was pretty obvious what those were. And that divided Eastern Europe into spheres of influence. So they split Poland, but this spheres of influence gave the Baltic states, Ukraine, Belarusia, half of Poland, to the influence of, or to be dominated by the USSR. The other half was the sphere of influence of Nazi Germany. And this arrangement actually involved a lot of trade of resources Russian resources for German manufactured goods largely. Eventually, though, after defeating France, Hitler's attention turned to the USSR. A lot of people will say, a lot of historians have pointed out, this was the long-range plan all along. And in 1941, June 22nd, the largest land invasion in history began, called Operation Barbarossa, named after Frederick Barbarossa, the German emperor of the centuries earlier. So it was over 3 million men on the German side, plus there were units from Romania, the Slovak Republic, and other allied countries. Eventually Hungary joined too, but that was a little bit later. And there were three groups, army groups north, center, and south. And they had three broad objectives: Leningrad, Moscow, and then Kyiv and beyond it. The Army Group North went the fastest for the first couple of weeks. The Army Group South had the strongest resistance, but it went the farthest just in terms of distance covered. Army Group Center got to Smolensk, and that was a great battle, but they went a lot slower than they thought they would. But on the way, the Germans managed to capture millions or hundreds of thousands of Red Army soldiers at a time. Great encirclements at Minsk, at Brest, at Kyiv was the largest. It was over 600,000 POWs taken. But they did slow down. A lot of people, and this is one of the things that I learned doing the research for the podcast, a lot of historians will point out the Germans really lost the war at the Battle of Smolensk, which was over at the end of July 1941. The war went on for another 3 years, but that was the point, because Hitler insisted that the Panzer forces, the tank, the armored forces, divide at that point. So instead, the generals wanted to keep going all the way to Moscow. Hitler insisted that no, we need to defend our flanks. So half the Panzer Group Panzer Group Three, went north to help on the drive on Leningrad and the siege of Leningrad. And Panzer Group Two went south to Ukraine. And because of that, the drive toward Moscow was paused for a while. Eventually in the fall, that drive was renewed. They got to within 19 miles of the Kremlin, but by then it was December and the winter hit. And but also importantly, the Red Army dug in, in fact, the entire population got involved in creating defensive lines, in counterattacks, and managed to halt the German advance by there. And then in December into January of 42, a great Soviet counterattack pushed the Germans back.
Yeah, I've read that Hitler believed he'd be able to defeat the Soviet Union in a matter of weeks, and apparently UK and US military intelligence also believed that could be done. Why were they also overconfident, and why did this end up not being the case?
Well, a lot of it was ideology. Hitler famously said, you know, Bolshevism is a rotten politics, and all you'd have to do is kick in the front door and the Soviet Union would collapse. And yes, the plan was they would reach Moscow by August 1st. But you know, clearly they were hundreds of miles from Moscow on August 1st. So that didn't work. They also did not expect the amount of resistance that they met. Especially, you know, there are the famous stories of German troops rolling into Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltics. And being greeted by the locals because they felt they were being liberated from communism. That did not turn out to be the case. People learned that lesson pretty quick. The other thing was German intelligence, military intelligence was faulty. They did not know just how large the Red Army really was, how many units or how many divisions, it was over 300 that they would be facing. And at the same time, the Soviets, Stalin, ordered whole armies that were stationed farther east in Siberia and the Far East and so on to be brought to the front because he had signed, and this is another little tidbit that a lot of people don't really realize, just before signing the Molotov-Ribbentrop, you know, non-aggression pact, they had signed and a similar pact with Japan. They had been fighting Japan in the Far East, in Mongolia. And then after that, they decided they had an assurance. And it turned out they could trust it because the Japanese focus was at that point on the Pacific and further south and to their east rather than in Asia.
Do you think Hitler's and the Nazis' surprisingly quick victories in Case Yellow in the Netherlands, Belgium, and France, do you think that gave them quite a lot of overconfidence and made them start Barbarossa a bit earlier than expected, or were they bound to start it this quickly after defeating France?
Yes, in the fact that, yeah, they had a lot of confidence. They had, you know, rolled through Poland, no problem. They had defeated France far faster than even they expected. And yes, you know, these were Hitler's decisions and the generals were saying, well, he hasn't been wrong yet, but Barbarossa actually started later than anticipated. When I was in high school, the theory was that they were delayed because they had to take Yugoslavia. The Italians got into trouble in the Balkans and Hitler sent his forces in there. That wasn't the whole thing. But yes, the plan was to take the USSR very quickly. Well, there's a few other things. The plan was that they would take the USSR within weeks, by August 1st, so 8 weeks or so. So if you're starting on June 22nd, you know, that means you're fighting in the summer. That's when it's dry, it's warm. You know, it's a lot easier for tanks and other armor to move around. The other thing is that they launched Barbarossa on the solstice, the longest day of the year. The artillery barrage started at 3:15 a.m., right? Dawn. So that gave them a lot of time. So I have to think that that must have figured into the calculations somehow.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Battle of Smolensk and Kyiv. Why were these battles so pivotal? And can you go into a bit more detail about these battles?
Well, Smolensk was harder than the Germans had anticipated. That was one thing. And they when doing the research on this and you know, delving into some of the statistics, which, you know, are more important in the podcast than for the books, the casualty rates are staggering. Tens of thousands of casualties on each side in every major operation. And so they did lose a lot. Smolensk was another area where there was a huge encirclement by the Germans of Red Army forces. But again, as I mentioned, what is important there is that after Smolensk, you know, it's on the road. It's famously the same route that Napoleon took to Moscow. And at that point, as I said, the drive toward Moscow paused, and the armored forces went north and south. Kyiv was a very important marker, both you know, strategically and psychologically. It was a great goal. It was the Soviet Union's, well, third city, I guess, capital of Ukraine, a major transportation hub, a manufacturing hub, and it just also, again, the biggest encirclement and capture of POWs in the war to that point. There were actually, I think, through the war. So again, it was close to 700,000 people captured. And that was a not only strategic and military blow, but also a great psychological blow to the Soviets, to the Soviet people.
Why did Moscow almost become a secondary objective at one point? And if the Nazis captured Moscow, would this change kind of the outcome of Barbarossa? Would it lead to the Soviet defeat?
There's, again, a lot of debate about that. And the thinking has changed over the years. Again, when I was in school and university learning about this, Moscow was, you know, and if you look at a map, especially the road or rail maps of Russia, you'll see that Moscow is the hub for everything. So, and it was a key manufacturing area. That's, you know, where they made weapons and tanks and rail cars and all sorts of things. So there's that. It was the political, and still is, the political center. And I remember reading something like this quite a long time ago. Even if the Germans had reached Moscow, there's still a lot of Russia. So you keep going to Russia. The Nazis' actual goal, their long-term goal, what they envisioned taking, was up what they called all of Europe. And to them, the border between Europe and Asia was the Volga River. So there was a line they drew from Archangel down, sort of skirting the Urals, but then hit the Volga River. So anything beyond that, they figured was Asia. You know, common thinking now is the border is the Ural River, the Ural Mountains, the Ural River. It's arbitrary no matter who's looking at it. It's one landmass.
anyway, that was the long-term goal. And, you know, they did reach the Volga. It took them longer than they thought, but yeah, taking Moscow, would it have made a difference? Did it make a difference to Napoleon?
Well, he didn't win, did he? So eventually.
What would have happened? We'll never know what would have happened because there's just no way to test it. But I kind of think even if the Germans had reached Moscow, they couldn't have won. And this is the thinking among most of the historians that I'm reading now, from James Holland to David Stahl to Anthony Tucker Jones, everybody is, there was no way Germany could win, right? It's a, I just spoke with Craig Luther. Germany at the time had a population of around 80 million and the Soviet Union had a population of 140 million. So there's just the question of resources. Germany's entire strategy from the beginning was, you know, blitzkrieg. We're going to be hit hard, hit fast. And if we don't do it fast, and this is what all the generals knew, Brautich, I guess is the better way to say it. Anyway, knew that if they don't win by summer, if 1941, we've lost.
Didn't Stalin have a lot of his resources pushed further away from Moscow as well? Yes. So surely if they captured Moscow, then they still would have had a lot of resources they could use to counterattack the Nazis once they captured it.
That's another part of it, is that Stalin made a lot of mistakes. Well, they both made a lot of mistakes, especially at the beginning of the war. But the smartest thing he did was immediately on the 22nd, ordered all the factories existed west of Moscow to be disassembled, shipped east into the, closer to the Urals or beyond the Urals, out of range of the German bombers. And the Germans never did develop a heavy long-range bomber. So it meant that they didn't have production at all for a year close to it. But when the factories did come online by 1942, late 1942, and especially by 1943, they were cranking out and they were using mass production techniques that they had learned from the Americans. And that turned the tide. I read the numbers are, especially from the Soviet Union, are hard to come by and not reliable. So they did make 60 to 80,000 of the T-34 series of medium tanks. Some people have called it the best tank of the war. It was probably the most effective tank of the war. It was the best, I mean, depends how you measure it, I guess. What do you mean by best? But it certainly made a big difference. And just think 80,000 of anything. And their production, and some historians have called this the war production, that's what made the big difference, is while Soviet production of war material was increasing greatly, German production was decreasing. So they did manage to churn out a lot more tanks. They developed some, the Tiger and the Panther, but they could never match the numbers. And by 1944, within 1944, they weren't producing enough anything to replace what they were losing, especially on the Eastern Front.
Isn't that quite similar to the Battle of Britain, where the British started off with not enough planes, but then their rate of production became quicker than the Luftwaffe's, and that eventually helped them win that battle?
Yeah, perhaps. I'm not really familiar with the statistics there, but it always did astound me that the British were able to produce not only like more and more Spitfires and Mosquitoes, but also that they kept innovating and they were bringing out new models of Spitfires,
and heavy bombers and medium bombers, and just the array of different kinds of airplanes. That really surprised me.
How come Germany couldn't keep up with the Soviets' production when they were taking so much land from them?
That's true. So this is another little wrinkle that you find. Yeah, first of all, the Germans didn't use the same sort of mass production techniques that the Americans and the Russians did. It was more of a, I think this is overstating it a bit, but it was more of a artisanal approach to it. So they had smaller, more scattered, smaller factories. So they weren't achieving the same sorts of scale. They also tended to use, so the one part of the thinking was, we're going to take the Škoda Works and the other manufacturing centers in Czechoslovakia, or had been broken up, Bohemia, and in Yugoslavia. The thing was, and then they took a lot of captured in French tanks and Czech tanks or Czech vehicles and so on. But the problem with that is every single one of them was different, manufactured to different standards, different engineering approaches, which meant they each had a different maintenance protocol. They took different spare parts. So getting the right spare parts to the battlefield where they were needed was a constant chore or challenge. Another thing that they always faced was a fuel shortage. They never had enough fuel. So as the Panzers are racing across the steppes in Ukraine, for example, kept having to stop first to let the infantry catch up, but also because they're running out of fuel. By the time the Battle of Stalingrad was happening, they had to curtail the amount of flights going in and out because they didn't have enough airplane fuel, so aviation fuel. So that was just another issue. Their main source of oil was Romania, the famous Ploiești airfields. And of course, part of the drive behind Operation Blue or Case Blue, which ended up at the Battle of Stalingrad, was to get the oil fields of the Caucasus. And that didn't work out because by the time the Germans did get there, the Soviets had set them on fire. So, and then they ended up not actually holding the area for very long, had to retreat from the Caucasus as well. So that whole oil drive was a bust.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Nazis get within 19 miles of Moscow.
19?
19, yeah. Yeah. 19, which is crazy to think about. How come they ended up failing Operation Typhoon despite getting that close? And what were some of the effective ways the Soviets defended Moscow?
Well, the entire population was pretty much drafted into building defenses. By that point, more armies had been brought up from the east. So they were arriving at the front and this is just the Soviet and current Russian approach to fighting a war is you just throw everything at it all at once. And it was a very strong, very stubborn defense. They did push the Germans back, but not all that far. And the front line did become fairly static west of Moscow for over a year. Pardon me. Drink of champions. So there was the famous Rzhev salient, or Rzhev, well, all calls called the Rzhev meat grinder. And for over a year, the Red Army tried to drive the Germans out of this big salient, a funny hook shape going north around the city of Rzhev, which is west of Moscow, northwest of Moscow. And it failed for over a year. And it was actually, the book was Zhukov's greatest failure, right? You know, the great Soviet general who took credit for defending Leningrad, just could not drive the Germans out of Rzhev or that deep salient. So there was a combination of things. There was the stubbornness of the defense, throwing all these armies into it. The entire civilian population gets into it. There was the scorched earth policy that denied the Germans any local supplies. And then, of course, the winter, the Germans were unprepared for it. Again, astounds me, they didn't have proper winter uniforms. You're going to Russia, it's October. Think a little bit. But anyway, again, mistakes that it's easy to look back now, of course, 80 years later can say, oh, yeah, well, that was dumb. Well, at the time, there's lots going on. Who knows what any of us would have done. But those were the factors that largely halted the Germans at the outside of Moscow.
Why didn't Hitler take into account a possibility of a winter campaign? Was it purely stubborn ignorance and overconfidence, or just?
I don't know. That's another, a lot of authors have wondered about that. Why didn't they? Part of it, and I've read this, I mean, I'm not going to try to get into his head or anybody's head. I think a lot of it was, pure chauvinism, thinking, well, we're Germans, we're better than Soviets, or we were better, the Nazis are better than the Bolsheviks. Germans are better soldiers than Russians, which there was some evidence for that. We haven't lost before. It was overconfidence. But there was also this thinking, and Hitler kept stressing this, of resisting defeatism. If you even brook the idea that we might not win, we might not achieve our goal, well, you're weakening the morale, you're a defeatist, and it's going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And I'm pretty sure that meant that he didn't allow even strategic retreats. Is that correct?
No retreats. And both Hitler and Stalin insisted on this, at least at the beginning. Stalin said, not one step back. And again, I've heard different stories on how serious this was. The stories were, the blocking detachments, they would shoot anyone who retreated. But yes, also throughout the war, Hitler ordered his generals, no retreats, do not take a step back. Even, at the end, toward the end of the war, 1944, ordered the fortress cities to be established. In other words, you're going to hang on to these key cities and fight to the last. Denied authority, denied permission for any sort of retreat. Denied the Sixth Army in 1942, 1943, permission to withdraw from Stalingrad, which led to their encirclement. Hitler expected Paulus, the general, which he promoted to field marshal in Stalingrad, to commit suicide for failing. Paulus didn't, which was a source of great frustration to Hitler, apparently. But it was the thinking, we can't retreat. Now, they did do some strategic withdrawals that actually did help. For example, they did withdraw from Demyansk, the Demyansk salient, a very deep salient. And then they did also in 1943 withdraw from, 43, from the Rzhev pocket, the Rzhev meat grinder. That freed up, that shortened their defensive line, because that's why you retreat sometimes. You withdraw strategically from an exposed position to strengthen your defenses. So they did reduce their front line by, I think, 200 miles or something. But more importantly, it freed up 20 divisions of soldiers and so on, which they then moved south for the Battle of Kursk or Operation Citadel. The biggest, been called the biggest tank battle in history.
In the long term, though, would have more strategic retreats actually, you know, helped them, or they'd end up losing anyway because of their lack of resources?
That's what most people think. Most of the historians, I'm not really a historian. I'm a podcaster, but I do read a lot. And that seems to be the thinking. They didn't have the size. Another thing to point out is just geography really mitigated against German success. Their strategy was the blitzkrieg. So, you know, the strong point of attack. But the problem with it is if you look at a map from the front line in 1941, the border between German-occupied Europe and the Soviet Union, from that point, if you're moving east, the geography spreads out. It gets wider. So as the Germans advanced, their line got wider and wider. And they had a finite number of people. So it means that the same force was stretched farther. It's diluted. So you're losing that whole idea of the German word is Schwerpunkt, the pointy end of the stick. It can't be pointy anymore. So there was that point. And again, they could never muster the resources, whereas the Soviet Union had, well, I don't want to say unlimited resources, but they, when they could get it organized, they had a lot more to bring to bear. I do like to stress the importance of lend-lease as well. So millions of tons of not just weapons, but food, clothing, supplies of all sorts, even locomotives and rail for building railroads were coming in mostly from the United States. Now, it did start, I think the first convoys did reach Murmansk, and Archangel was the first in 1941, but it didn't really get going until 1942, reached sort of a peak volume toward the end of the war. But it did make a big difference. And as I pointed out in my book, and this is something my father-in-law did tell me, it's that in 1941, they didn't have enough to eat. And that's why I called the book Army of Worn Souls. They were walking and retreating so fast and so far that the soldiers' boots wore out and they didn't have replacements. And so the men would wrap newspapers around their legs or stuff them into their boots just for some protection.
Are there any other less cited reasons for the Nazis' defeat on the Eastern Front that you've discovered?
Less cited? A lot of the historians I've read have pointed out just it was a resources thing. It was the size, the relative size of the two countries, the amount of resources. Germany just didn't have the sufficient fuel or oil. They had a lot of ingenious ways to, they synthesized oil from coal, for example. Again, geography plays a large point on this. So they've got the Soviet Union on the east, whereas on the west, to bring in supplies from anywhere around the world, they had to get past Britain, right? Because Britain by virtue of its location could blockade Germany quite well. Although it didn't prevent the U-boats from getting out there. But the Battle of the Atlantic had a major impact as well, because eventually through better techniques and better technology, the Allies were able to bring more of their supplies past and defeat the U-boat packs. So they were bringing more supplies in from the west, and also to the Soviet Union as well as to Britain and continental Europe. Germany was surrounded, And that's you know, of course, that's the classic thing, the two-front war. How can you win a two-front war? Well, the United States did so. But again, it's resources. How much can you produce? How fast can you produce it? German technology was superior, but it was just, you know, volume. That's what I think it, a lot of it was, is just the volume they were facing two, you know, vast or three vast world-spanning empires. It was just too much.
Yeah. And they end up becoming another Western European army who underestimate the Russian bear. Why have armies systematically underestimated Russia throughout history?
I don't think they're underestimating the Russian army now. I think a lot of people overestimated them now in 2020, in the 21st century. But yeah, I think part of it in the 1930s was, again, technology. Russia, the Soviet Union, was so big, and communication wasn't what it is today. There were no satellites to spy. So Germany did not know how extensive the Red Army was, how many armies there were. So they underestimated that. I think they overestimated their own abilities. And you know, there was a whole, the ideology, you know, of Nazism. I think that's the major failure. The reason is just the ideology was so evil and so just wrongheaded. You know, of course we'll win. We're better. You know, an overconfidence in yourself is one thing. It's great to be confident, but unrealistic about the abilities of your enemy, of your adversary, is going to just cause disaster. Yeah, so there was that, and then they just didn't know. There's a lot of, as I read, you know, various things, there's a lot of things about German military intelligence that just they missed, right? There was the whole Operation Mincemeat, right? Where the British put a body in the water in the Mediterranean with fake papers that indicated the plan was to invade Greece instead of Sicily. And just how the Germans sort of not only found it, but the many mistakes along the way from, you know, the Spanish authorities finding this body and the German authorities inspecting it and all these other errors that they made, it just kind of astounded me. They just, much as movies and television shows portray, you know, the Gestapo and the SS and ESD as being so fearsome and so precise and so capable, they made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah. Speaking of ideology, I've read that the German soldiers were given freedom to commit atrocities against Soviet civilians, while special mobile unit killing squads executed Jewish and Slavic people as the front line moved forward. Some historians have suggested that if Hitler had developed a more sympathetic attitude to the people he conquered, they might have aided him in his fight with Stalin. Do you agree with this view? If you want to go from no podcast and zero subscribers to a professional looking and sounding podcast with big named guests, loyal audience, and a lot of momentum in 3 months, the link for my step-by-step video podcast blueprint program is in the description below. If you sign up and buy that, you'll also get my episodes 24 hours early. You'll get guest previews. You'll be able to ask guests questions for me to ask them on my show. You'll also meet a group of like-minded, curious people who either want to start their own podcast or want to improve themselves and understand the world around them. So link for that in the description. Let's get on to the next section.
Maybe I a few things about that, and contradictory things. I one of the things my father-in-law liked to tell me was that the betrayal, apparently, as the Germans were first moving into moving east, the Nazis promised freedom for all the nations, right? So, yeah, the Baltic nations, Ukraine, they would be free from communism. They could set up their own governments. And, okay, the Ukrainians did that, and the entire government was arrested within a week. So there was that sense of betrayal. But I think it was, I just don't think the Nazi ideology permitted them to be sympathetic to their conquered peoples. You know, the whole idea, well, the ideas were eliminate all the Jewish people, just get rid of them, and enslave the Slavs. The plan was reduce the Slavic population in Ukraine by at least half through starvation, take the other half and make them into slave labor. And eventually they would wither away and to be replaced by Germans in Lebensraum, right? In fact, there were some places in Poland where they tried to, you know, install German families on this land. And not very many people actually took up the offer. And eventually they were all driven out or killed by the returning Red Army. So, or by partisans. So there's that side of it as well. But as far as, yeah, and the atrocities were great. And a lot of, when the Red Army came back and pushed into Germany, they committed atrocities, incredible numbers. And rape was a Soviet weapon of war, an approved one. But a lot of people, the common wisdom was, well, it was revenge. You know, and so, yeah, maybe if the Germans hadn't committed these atrocities, the Soviets would not have committed the atrocities in return. By looking at Russia's action in Ukraine today and hearing about the continuing and massive numbers of war crimes being committed, I wonder if it's this, that's just not how, you know, the Russian ethos as far or approach to war and approach to taking over other lands. That's just part of the whole protocol. So, again, it's a counterfactual, you know, we can't really know. Maybe they would have been gentler if the Germans had been gentler, but I don't think that the German or the Nazis could have been, according to their own philosophy, gentler. And so, the whole argument just, it seems, you know, unanswerable, I guess.
Yeah. Do you think war crimes are most, I don't want to say futile, but almost part of human nature, the fact that it's been repeated so many times throughout history that these like atrocities have been made when one tribe's conquering another? Is it almost just a byproduct of war that people can't do much about, or?
I think, yeah, there probably always will be some, especially in these situations, people are, understandably angry, and are reacting quickly and emotionally, but they don't have to be, they don't have to reach the levels that we saw in the Second World War or in many other places. And as we see today, when the rules are in place, when the leaders know this is the moral way or the right way to carry out, which is essentially an immoral act. I mean, war is just organized mass murder. But when you do focus on a particular goal, in the end, war crimes are not going to help you, right? Atrocities, you know, they end up backfiring. They make
they just make the population resent you, hate you, and they're going to want revenge. So it just becomes part of this cycle. So the smart thing to do, and again, I'm not a military person. I've had no military training, but it seems to me that the smart thing to do is to do the right thing, to do the ethical thing. And then when it is all over, it's that much easier to bring about some sort of accommodation between two sides. Maybe, you know, sure, you may never love each other. But if you take a look at Western Germany, right, after the Second World War, the Americans and the West, rest of the West did help the Germans rebuild. And Germany is now integral part of the Western alliance, Western culture.
Yeah, it shows there's an alternative way to almost defeat and capture certain states. I was also just wondering about the long sieges of Leningrad and Stalingrad. Were the Soviets underdogs in those battles, and how did they end up winning?
Well, Leningrad, after the Germans did reach Leningrad, now, again, Hitler sort of changed the goalposts. So the idea was the Germans would come up to Leningrad from the south and west. Meanwhile, the Finns were supposed to come from the north and west, and also sort of in that narrow isthmus in Karelia, but also around Lake Ladoga or Ladoga. Not sure how you're supposed to pronounce it, and link up with the Germans there. The Finns were reluctant. They wanted the territory back that they had lost in the Winter War, but they really weren't that anxious about taking a lot of Russian territory. Who needs it? And so they got very close to Leningrad from the north. And they did get partway around Lake Ladoga, but they never did link up with the Germans on the eastern side of the lake. And this is what allowed that very thin, lifeline for Leningrad. But then by the winter of 1941, Hitler said, well, we're not going to take Leningrad. We're going to besiege it. We're going to starve it. And eventually, I think, was it that when the plan was to turn it into a lake? And a resort for German officers. And also then famously Zhukov flew in to Leningrad in the winter and to take over the defense. And he ordered, not another step back, and famously ordered that, if the Germans were doing this, they'd bringing up captured civilians to plead with the defenders of Leningrad, surrender. And so if Zhukov said, if you see your grandmother pleading for you to surrender, shoot her. So again, that's the Soviet, especially Zhukov, was particularly ruthless.
Yeah. And what about Stalingrad? You mentioned they end up getting encircled.
Yeah, Stalingrad was a complicated operation, and the amazing thing is that the Soviets always hung on, even to the smallest bit, but they never let go of the final bit of the western side of the Volga. They were dug in there, they had tunnels and so on. They were also continuing to fight in the factory section in the northern part of the city. They called it the Rattenkrieg. The Germans called it the Rattenkrieg, the Battle of Rats, because they were fighting under rubble. They were crawling around all the time. And part of the irony is that as the German bombers destroyed so much of the buildings and the infrastructure, it created more places for the Red Army soldiers to hide. And so snipers, then there's the famous fictitious sniper duel between Zaitsev
and the entirely fictitious German Colonel Jaeger. But there was sniping was a major concern. There was the Red Army also, this was real, Pavlov's house. There was a five-story building that they stubbornly hung on to, and it was used as a great vantage point for snipers. And the Germans only eventually cleared it out at great risk and cost, but the defenders in there did manage to get out. But what eventually happened was, again, this is the very farthest limit of German supply lines. It was took a long time and a lot of fuel just to bring supplies, anything to Stalingrad. And of course, winter eventually came. And again, you think they'd learned the lesson from the previous winter. Again, the Axis forces did not have proper winter gear. The Soviets did. And Zhukov and Vasilevsky planned, and Timoshenko was involved in it too. But again, Zhukov took credit. He was good at that. And planned this Operation Uranus, basically surrounding Stalingrad and shrinking the area that the Germans could hold on to more and more. So they had at first three airfields, then two airfields, then one airfield. But again, there were never enough planes. There was never enough fuel. And the Soviets kept shooting down the German planes, the Luftwaffe's transport and fighter or warcraft aircraft. It was an impossible situation. The Germans or all the Axis forces were starving by January 1943. Even Paulus was put himself on the same rations as his men. His top aides did not. So if you think of the famous picture of Paulus and his top people surrendering, he looks emaciated, but the men around him do not. And so but a few of the things that the Soviets did right there was, they brought in all these new armies. They reorganized new fronts. General Chukov was a very capable and stubborn man and did manage to, keep his men all people, there were women fighting as well, motivated, kept the morale as high as he could. Also, the tanks and the armored vehicles that the Soviets brought in for Operation Uranus were equipped for snow, whereas while the panzers got bogged down, the T-34s and other tanks were equipped with extra wide tracks so they could go over the snow, blast through a snowdrift, almost like it wasn't there. So they really overwhelmed the Germans in that attack. Also, there were Hungarian and Italian forces, importantly, there guarding the flanks. But they were just, they're under-equipped. They're running out of ammunition. They're out of fuel. They're out of food. And they lost hundreds of thousands of men. It was the Sixth Army, when it arrived in Stalingrad, it was the Germans' biggest army and had been whittled away to, under 100,000 men by the end of the campaign, when they surrendered in February of 1943.
That's just incredible that their biggest army just gets withered away that much.
Yeah.
Just kind of almost pure determination from the Soviets. What would happen if Leningrad and Stalingrad both get captured? Were the Nazis planning to go all the way to Moscow from there?
Some historians have said that the Germans kind of stumbled into Stalingrad. They didn't really expect to go there. There are quotes from some of the German generals that at the beginning of Operation Blue, the invasion of the Caucasus, Stalingrad was just a place on a map, a spot on the map. It was important to the Soviets because the only all-weather route came up from Iran, over the Caspian Sea and then up the Volga River. So Stalingrad was an important way station on the river. Now, the factories were important, of course, by the time, by August 1942, they were gone, but they that was one of the sites where the tanks were built, and a lot of other equipment, railroad cars and track and so on. So it was an important manufacturing hub. So if the Germans had taken Stalingrad, it might have helped them a bit. The more important point for them, though, would be the Caucasian oil fields. That's why they went to Stalingrad in the first place, or to, you know, beyond the Black Sea in the first place. And so if, I think that's the more critical question. If they had actually captured the oil fields in Grozny, and I mean, the goal was Baku on the Caspian Sea. Maybe if they had taken that, things would have been different. But again, you're talking about, you know, the distances are incredible. Thousands of kilometers between, well, Berlin, but even the German frontier, as far east as it was at that point, and Asia, Kazakhstan. You know, it's really, I just unrealistic to think that they could have held on to that unless all the people in the area of those lands came around to their side. And I don't think that could have happened. As far as Leningrad goes, Leningrad was an important manufacturing hub again. And yeah, there's stories of the tanks rolling off the assembly lines in Leningrad straight to the front line without paint, right? So just, you know, tighten the final bolt and head out. So I think, yeah, they might have lost, had they lost that manufacturing site, that might have made a difference if they had linked up with the Finns. But again, look at the map. The farther you go into Russia, there's more Russia.
Yeah. Yeah. What role did the Polish Home Army play in disrupting the Nazi operations? Because I've heard you mention they're often quite overlooked by the West. Why do you think they're so overlooked, and what role did they play?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because I recently did an episode on the Home Army. They were very important. The Polish people never really surrendered, even though the government had to decamp and eventually set up in London. The Home Army conducted continuing partisan operations against the Germans. They brought out more information, more intelligence to the Allies. And there was a quote that I mentioned in the episode, that it was always reliable. They always gave very valuable, very reliable information about German troop movements and strength and whatever plans they could glean. It was the Poles who told the world about the Holocaust, about the concentration camps. It was the even before the war, Polish cryptographers broke the German Enigma code and managed to steal some of the code books. And I believe they even got one Enigma machine. The British managed to get another one from Norway, from a captured ship. So that was very important. The Poles managed to smuggle out key components of a V2 rocket the Allies they brought the pieces from Peenemünde, which is where the base was. They brought pieces from a test rocket to Warsaw, did some analysis, and then managed to get the pieces on a plane that flew out of a disused air base back to England. So that was important too. Then there was the tragedy, of course, of the Warsaw Uprising in 1944 in August, or went from August to September. And they had timed it for, they were ready. They had weapons, but only light weapons. They had a couple of sort of jerry-rigged armored cars, and they did manage to get a hold of some medium, assault guns and so on, captured ones. But mostly it was, handguns and a few submachine guns, captured rifles and so on. They had time, so they were ready. And when the Soviet Red Army was approaching, that's when they rose against the Germans. And there was a communist Polish People's Army that was sponsored and controlled by Moscow, by the Soviet High Command. Some units of that army did reach the outskirts of Warsaw on the Vistula River in August, but were unable to do much. And this is another debate. Did Stalin deliberately, refrain from sending the Red Army into Warsaw to link up with the home army and capture the city? Or did he hold back? Was it a deliberate strategy, or was it, as the Soviets claimed, we had to stop, we were beyond our supply lines. We had to wait for, we had reached our culmination point east of Warsaw. We were unable to do much about that. That's a debate that continues today.
What do you think?
I think it was, it was deliberate. Stalin did not want the Home Army to succeed, because the Home Army answered to, or was loyal to, the Polish government in exile in London. Stalin wanted to install a communist government. So I think that was his, I think it was deliberate. Let them fight it out. Let them weaken each other. That'll make it easier for the Red Army to take over and then install the people that we prefer.
Seems to again be an ideology problem with the Nazis, in the sense that the Polish helped the Allies so much because their views and ideology was more aligned with the Allies, and because the Nazis wanted to get rid of the Poles, which is quite interesting, because I've heard and listened to and read that the Polish people were treated just like the Slavs and almost like the Jews, even though they were technically quite Aryan and quite Christian, which is kind of ironic in a way.
Again, it's a little bit, but it's a very complex area. And so again, what was Germany? What was Poland? That border was very, not porous, but not even, not definite, right? So in terms of the people who live there, Poles are Slavs. Polish is a Slavic language, although I find it the hardest to pronounce of the Slavic languages, not being Slavic myself, but it was an ideological thing. The Poles were the Untermensch, and they were right there, right? They were the next door neighbors. So if you want more Germany, well, that's the place to start, right? Czech or Bohemia as well. How, ethnically, are they more German or are they more Slavic? Well, I don't know. It doesn't really matter anyway, but and I think it would be really hard to determine that, especially closer to the border. So, was Danzig a German city? Was it a Polish city? Again, a debate. But if you're going to draw those hard lines, then you're going to end up committing some sort of brutality.
Yeah, and the Nazi ideology kind of made it impossible for them to be accommodating to the Polish people and other countries they've captured, which in the long term shot themselves in the foot, because,
Yeah, it's racially based and therefore completely illogical. It's just, you know, apparently, supposedly, Hitler had some sympathy for the British, saw them as another Germanic Nordic race. Okay. Again, you know, so what about the French then? What about the Dutch? Well, you were brutal to them. And then he had this weird idea of sort of the Baltic people being sort of in between. Were they Germanic? Were they not Nordic? As far as a way of organizing your view of the world and from there, your politics, completely unworkable.
Isn't it debatable that Hitler did sympathize for the British? It's not necessarily true. I've heard different kind of opinions on that.
Yes. And he wasn't exactly consistent through the war in his own pronouncements and views either. Maybe at first he thought we could be friends with the British, but then that thinking probably changed by 1940. There are so many different views. And another problem that I found, and I want to dig into this in my podcast, is just the historicity, the change in our thinking and in what we know about the Eastern Front. So famously, David Glantz got access to a lot of Soviet records after the end of the Soviet Union in the 1990s. That information, that's new information that we didn't have access to before. So that changed a lot of our understanding and the depth of knowledge that we now can access about the war on the Eastern Front. That is, again, changed. That door has closed, but a lot of very capable historians have dug up a lot of really good information. So starting with David Glantz, David Stahl, Anthony Beevor, these are great, invaluable resources and paint such a different picture of not just the war on the East, but the whole Second World War from what I was taught in high school and in university. There's also the shift. There was a lot of English language World War II history up to probably 1990 that was oddly sympathetic to the Germans. There was the whole myth promulgated by a lot of German generals like Guderian, who survived the war, that the Wehrmacht was good, the Nazis were bad, the SS were the bad guys. The rest of us were honorable soldiers, serving our country, always behaving ethically and properly and honorably. And now we know that's BS. I'd like to sort of, I don't know, maybe it'd be good to have a panel discussion or something, like have a few historians and say, let's explore this idea, this change in our understanding of the war, but also our approach to doing the research and to interpreting what we find. I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah, well, it's not exactly a scientific approach,
no.
History at all. So it's always going to be slightly biased and slightly kind of not, I don't know if flawed the right word, but it's never going to be completely accurate.
No, it can't be, because again, first rule of journalism, the first lesson of journalism school, I used to be a journalist, was there's no such thing as objectivity. So because we're human and we're limited, we're always going to see things through from our own point of view. It's going to be colored by what we've experienced in the past.
And also, when it comes to history, especially looking at the Second World War, so not many people are left alive who were there. So we're looking at records. Again, written records are recorded by people who are looking at events from their perspective, freighted by their own baggage and their own experiences. And then we've got to, you know, we're always looking at this, okay, well, how much of this is, you know, pure ideology? How much of this is recording something so that, you know, because my boss, my commanding officer wants to hear it? How much of this am I recording so that I don't get shot for failure? How much of this am I trying to hide because I will get into trouble? We're sifting through multiple layers of interpretation. And then, of course, for me, I'm looking at this from another layer of interpretation, because I'm reading these books that are interpreting these other records. So it gets very murky. So yeah, I do think you have to kind of keep an open mind, not in terms of morality or ethics, but in terms of, okay, how much of this is really accurate? And really be careful of anyone who says, oh, you know, Stalin was thinking this, Hitler was thinking that, Brauchitsch was motivated by this or that, von Bock was motivated by something else. Maybe plausibly we can see that, but I think we have to really focus on the actions that we can see. And also remember that there's a lot of stuff, there's still a lot of areas that, despite all this research and, you know, people digging into records in Russia and in Germany and elsewhere, in the States, remembering that there's still a lot of holes, right? There's still a lot of missing information. You know, things burned. Record paper burns really easily. So there's a lot that we don't know and probably will never know until someone invents a time machine.
Yeah, but it is a shame that that's the case, but it's something that we have to deal with.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like any history, you know, another area of history that I've been interested in is the, you know, the late Roman Empire. And there's a lot of stuff that has just disappeared, right? And you read historical accounts of the history of Rome or whatever, and they talk about various historians from the time, but you know their writings are lost. We only have fragments of some histories, so we're doing a lot of interpretation. So we have to look at physical evidence where we can, and even that it's not complete.
Yeah, looking at the present day, do you think the effects of Barbarossa still influence Russian geopolitics today?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, they're quite explicit about this, you know, that we are, you know, defending the motherland. There are ongoing references to the Great Patriotic War. Russia to this day calls any of its enemies Nazis, whether they are, you know, they're Jewish. Well, that's a Nazi. So it very much colors that. The whole idea of buffer zones. We can't let these states join an alliance against us. We need this buffer zone. That's even before the Second World War. It very much colors. And from what I've read and heard, that idea of, you know, we are surrounded by enemies and we cannot let this happen again, very much informs even, you know, popular culture and the way people feel about their government in Russia. So we are still living with those, you know, the borders of all the countries in Europe were set in 1945. So yeah, it's very much relevant today. And that's why we need to understand.
Yes. And do you think that lack of a buffer zone today and the geographical presence of the great northern European plain means that the conflict, like the one in the Eastern Front in World War II, is likely to happen again? Do you think that geographical kind of vulnerability can...
No, I think warfare has changed a lot. You know, it's not about driving tanks around anymore. But also, I think it's the mutual attitude toward each side. You know, Germany and France are allies now. And Poland. So it's, yeah, I don't think that geography is determinant. It makes a big difference. But I don't think it's inevitable that, you know, Russia doesn't have, and now I'm sounding like Trump. Russia doesn't have to be our enemy, but the current leadership in Russia is determined to be the West's enemy. That's not inevitable. And also, yeah, there are a lot of wide open plains that are conflict free. I live in one. I think there is peace in a rapprochement that is possible, but I think both sides, I mean, yeah, I'm more sympathetic to the West, but I think there's a shift in thinking that's required.
Yeah. And should we always expect there to be even a low probability of Russia expanding westward?
Given the current leadership there, yes, he will take every opportunity. We've seen that. He's an opportunist. Putin is an opportunist. And so if he sees an opening, he will take it. He saw an opportunity. He thought he saw an opportunity in Ukraine and took it. You know, he expanded in 2014 into Crimea and the Donbass. He expanded before that into Georgia, taking parts of Georgia. There are ongoing operations throughout the Caucasus. I doubt, I don't get into the Far East, you know, they're there as well. There are Russian ships going through the Northwest Passage. Yeah, if Putin, there are Russian forces building up along the Finnish border, and the Estonian border. So I think that if Putin sees an opportunity to take more land, he will.
And what does that look like from a Russian perspective? What is the mindset behind that, if you have any knowledge about it?
Yeah, well, I can only go by the news I read and the reports I hear on the radio or on podcasts. I listen to a number of podcasts about the Eastern Front. And it seems that despite, you know, the internet and so on, the Kremlin's control of information in Russia is pretty... not quite complete, but it is very powerful. And so apparently a lot of the people in Russia still see a threat. You know, they see the operation, and the operation is characterized and emphasized as defensive. And, you know, they are re-educating Ukrainian people to be good Russian, or Ukrainian children to be good Russians. And they see this as, you know, positive for the kidnapped children. They see, you know, any operation or any criticism as an existential threat. So I think it's going to take a lot of work to turn that around.
And can Russia be allies with the West in the future? Do you think that's a possibility?
Yes, it could be. And it would need a different leadership. I see no reason. Fundamentally, I don't see any reason for anybody to be enemies. If you just say, yeah, you do you, I'm going to let you do what you want as long as you don't interfere with me doing what I want. Yeah, there's going to be conflicts, of course, but those can be managed, you know, and we do manage these things. We manage, you know, water resources between countries. We manage fisheries. We manage, you know, we agree about oceans and air travel. These things are all can all be worked out. So I don't see any reason, any real reason, concrete reason for Russia to be an enemy of the West.
For a few ending questions, I've got one that looks a bit into the future. Do you think colonizing other planets like Mars will unite Earth, or will there always be tribal wars on our spinning pale blue dot?
Earth. You know, much as I used to be a science fiction fan, you know, love the Martian Chronicles. I don't think we'll ever be one big, happy, united planet like in Star Trek, right? There are always people who think that, and I find this very strange. I just don't think this way, but it seems to me that there, people wanting other people to think like them and, you know, worship like them and see any deviation from that thought as a threat, that's the problem. And I don't see it really going away. So, yeah, I think there will always be human conflict, unfortunately. I wish it wasn't true, but it just seems to me that's the way it is.
Yeah, tribalism, in-group bias, out-group bias seem embedded in our psyche.
Yeah, which is, despite all the universal sort of, the religions that claim to be universal, they're not. And again, they require you to, there's just so much intolerance that, and I don't know why it's built, it seems built into the psyche that you see someone dressing different or acting different as a threat.
I don't know either, but I guess because we evolved growing and living in tribes and resources were maybe more limited back then, we were hardwired to believe that it's a zero-sum game. So one of the final questions is, what are the best World War II books that you've read so far, if you could choose a couple to recommend?
If it's just about the Eastern Front, I get a lot out of Evan Maudsley's book, Thunder in the East. And I did get a lot out of a couple books by, I'm just pulling them up here. Come on. By Anthony Tucker Jones and David Stahl. David Stahl has done some really deep analysis of German action in the East, in the Eastern Front. So I really got a lot out of his book, Operation Barbarossa and Germany's Defeat in the East. Anthony Tucker Jones' Slaughter on the Eastern Front, Evan Maudsley's Thunder in the East. And then quite valuable. I just read and interviewed the author, Craig Luther, wrote a book about called, well, he's written a couple, but Operation Barbarossa, The First Day on the Eastern Front, Operation Barbarossa, 1941. And, so those are a few of the books I got a lot out of. David Glantz's books, let's see, what's that one called? I used. So just so I can make sure I got it right. Oh, dear. The name escapes me now. But,
no worries.
I think I had him from a physical book from the library. David Glantz has written some of the most revealing books. for sort of a general outline, Anthony Beevor's excellent books on the Second World War and on the on the Eastern Front and on Berlin are very good. So there's so many books, and I'll never read them all, although I should. But yeah, those are the ones that I got a lot out of. Also, a really interesting book it came out recently by Claire Mulley, a book called Agent Zoe, about one of the most valuable and prolific Polish agents from the Home Army throughout the war, so from 1939 to 1945, and then about her life after that. That was, well, it's really well written, a gripping story as well.
Yeah, I'll be sure to add them to the reading list. They sound very fascinating.
Yeah.
Final question. If you could give one piece of advice to your 20-year-old self, what would it be?
20-year-old, buy Apple stock.
That is a good piece of advice. Scott,
what would I tell my 20-year-old self? Dig deeper into all the stories that I wrote then, and start writing my fiction earlier. Mm. I really put that off for a long time, and I mean, I was busy writing as a journalist. It's a different sort of muscle that you exercise. So I would start writing the fiction earlier.
Yeah, take action earlier. That's a good, good piece of advice. Scott Berry, ladies and gentlemen, Scott, I absolutely love your work.
Oh, thank you.
I really appreciate your time, and I hope the audience learned as much about the Eastern Front as I have with you today. Where can people go if they want to find your incredible work?
Well, the podcast is called Beyond Barbarossa, and it's available on all the podcasting platforms. My books are available. So the Eastern Front trilogy is Army of Worn Souls, Under the Nazi Heel, and Walking Out of War. And they're available as either three individual ebooks from Amazon or as a one volume paperback called The Eastern Front. And you can find those on Amazon or on all the other book e-tailers. And I'm not sure about in Europe, but in North America, they're available through major bookstores. If it's not on their shelf, and it probably isn't, you can ask for them to order it.
Brilliant. I'll leave the links in the show notes for the audience to access. What projects are you currently working on the moment?
Well, I'm working on episode 78 now. So the next episode will be about Operation Bagration or Bagration, depending on how you pronounce it. And I'm working on some fiction. I'm working on an espionage thriller set in the current conflict in Ukraine.
Brilliant. I'll be sure to check it out.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Okay. Thank you, Jacob.
Brilliant. Cheers. If you want to know the full step-by-step process I use to go from zero subscribers and zero guests and zero idea of how to start a podcast to a ton of high-end guests, professional-looking video, professional-looking audio quality, social media clips of the podcast that have generated over 2.5 million views in the last 2 to 3 months, and join my tribe of outliers. It's a community for curious, like-minded people who either want to start their own podcast or are interested in improving themselves and understanding the world around them too. You'll get access to my step-by-step podcast blueprint program, as well as many other self-improvement videos, which can help you improve your life. You'll finally be able to meet your like-minded tribe of people who are into podcasting, into self-growth, and into understanding the world around them. Because let's be real, the people that are into those three things are very rare individuals. That's why I called it Tribe of Outliers. So if you want to know how to start your podcast using the blueprint I used to go from zero to a successful show that's continuing to grow to this day, literally, I'll hold your hand and walk you through the step-by-step process, including how to email guests, what to put in your emails, how to edit it, how to repurpose it, how to use Riverside FM software, but also how to do it all with the equipment I've said in this video, how to network with guests, how to write video descriptions, where to upload it to. I will just tell you every single step to turn you into a pro podcaster and get big name guests and a loyal audience like I have, as well as getting my episodes 24 hours before anyone else, getting guest previews before the show even comes out, as well as join weekly live calls with myself and the tribe, helping you improve your podcast and yourself every single week. It's an absolute no-brainer. It's for curious people who are in self-improvement and also who want to start their own podcast. So if you want to become an outlier today and join the tribe of like-minded people and get direct access to me and my blueprints, which have helped me improve my podcast and my life, click the link in the description